All right, so I don't want you to be afraid of this show. On the other hand, many of the things that will be said on this show will make you afraid. So there's the paradox, and the resolution to the paradox is knowing stuff is always better. Knowing a lot about something that is potentially really quite dangerous is always better than knowing almost nothing. Now, speaking of knowing almost nothing, you might have missed this story, all right? It happened in May of this year, not that long ago. It might have been like a Stormy Daniels day or so. There was something else going on, I guarantee you. there was something else going on. So this is the version written actually by our friend Lena Sun of The Washington Post. The top White House official responsible for leading the U.S. response in the event of a deadly pandemic has left the administration, and the global health security team he oversaw has been disbanded under a reorganization by National Security Advisor John Bolton. The abrupt departure of Rear Admiral Timothy Zimmer from the National Security Council means no senior administration official is now focused solely on global health security. Zimmer's departure, along with the breakup of his team, comes at a time when many experts say the country is already underprepared for the increasing risks of a pandemic or bioterrorism attack. Zimmer's last day was Tuesday, the same day a new Ebola outbreak was declared in Congo. He is not being replaced. So that should worry. That should not only worry you, it should make you kind of mad, too. And it's good that you know that, right? Maybe you can do something about it at some point. Maybe not. We're going to talk to a lot of people today about pandemics, also sometimes known as plagues. We're going to also talk about the 100th anniversary of the so-called Spanish flu outbreak in 1918 that killed somewhere between 2.5 and 5% of the world's population. So that's coming towards the end, but we're going to go through a few of our contemporary problems. We're going to start with Ed Yong, who writes about science for The Atlantic and is the author of, and he was on our show for this really interesting topic, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and a Grander View of Life. His most recent article, When the Next Plague Hits, appears in the July-August print edition of The Atlantic, and he's with us right now. So, Ed, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
And you heard me read that news article. So let's say I could get you some FaceTime with John Bolton to talk about this. What would you tell him? How would you try to convince him? I assume you see this as a terrible mistake. So how would you try to convince him?
I do. I met Tim Zimmer at the White House last year when I was trying to report on this piece. I would say that in times of crisis, it is very useful for the administration to have reliable experts on hand. I think Zimmer's credentials were unquestionable. The man had led malaria work, work in fighting malaria overseas for many, many years. He was a veteran of public health, very well respected, very formidable person. And without him there is a hole in the expertise available to the administration. Now, that there's not no expertise. The person who, one of the people Zimmer was working very closely with, is now overseeing work on pandemic preparedness and getting the White House's strategy on that in place. And her name is Andrea Hall. But she is now in charge of not just preparedness against infectious threats, against diseases and pandemics, but against things like weapons of mass destruction and terrorist attacks and nuclear proliferation and all of that stuff. And this, I would say to Bolton, is something that past administrations have done before, of trying to streamline and package these responsibilities into smaller teams. And they have almost always reversed that decision because it turns out to be a bad idea, right? If you have more responsibility falling on one particular person, that person's time is then stretched thin, as is their attention.
Okay, so, but Ed, I think also you have to, in this mythical conversation you're having with John Bolton, presumably he doesn't take this all that seriously, or he wouldn't be dismantling the team that's in charge of. So make it the case to John that that this is a much more pressing concern and should be way, way higher on his agenda or his hierarchy of concerns.
Okay, so I would say that history has clearly taught us that new diseases can have an immense impact on society, and that the pace at which those diseases are emerging is, if anything, increasing. So we have seen over the last few decades how something like HIV can come out of nowhere and suddenly become a problem for the entire world. We have seen through SARS how new diseases can rapidly spread through to new continents, even though no one had ever heard of them before. Ebola teaches us how diseases that we are familiar with can lead to ridiculous new outbreaks. Zika tells us the same lesson. Flu shows us how things that we know can go pandemic can create new pandemics in ways that we are unprepared for. Combined with the fact that there are more people than ever alive in the world now, more of them now living in urban centres where it's much easier for diseases to spread. Our infrastructure for dealing with diseases is spread very thinly, and investments are shaky and uncertain. And the fact that international travel is so prolific and so frequent. We live in a world in which there are more threats, in which those threats are more easily spread from person to person. And this is something the world needs to take seriously. I'm going to quote Bill Gates in saying that pandemic threats are the ones that really keep him up at night, like more so than anything else. It's the thing that's most likely going to that has the highest chance of killing large numbers of people in the future. And I think it's a thing that we keep on needing to be reminded of as a threat. New things come up, the world panics, resources and attention are paid to the problem, and then the threats subside and we lapse into forgetfulness and short-sightedness. And I think that's sort of where we are now with things like the loss of people like Tim Zima, the lack of expertise in the White House. On that day when Zima was resigned, Trump suggested that he was going to cut this $252 million pot of money that was designed to to help control future outbreaks of things like Ebola on the same day that a new Ebola outbreak arrived in the Congo. So, we keep on making this mistake, and it's a bizarre self-inflicted wound. We do not need to be bad at this, and yet societally, we have repeatedly been so.
So there's sort of two phases of thinking about this, at least the way that it seems to me. One of them is the second one is, what are we going to do when people start coughing? What are we going to do when there's something knocking at our door? But the first part of it is, how can we have this happen less often? And how can we have it happen less pervasively and radically? Mm-hmm. And so there we really are talking about kind of development in the rest of the world, right? As researchers look at this stuff, one of the things that they say is really the biggest driver of outbreaks is a lack of what you could call, in a very broad way, public health infrastructure, right? I mean, maybe you could say something about that.
Yeah. So in most of these cases, we have some kind of disease, usually some kind of virus, leaping from an animal host into a human population. Those points of contact are growing as people push into areas of wilderness and come into contact with animals in very biodiverse regions. We talked about the Congo, that's one of them, but this applies to places all around the world, to farms, to bushmeat markets. There are many opportunities for viruses to leap across. Now, I don't think, and I think a lot of people would agree, that there's a reasonable chance of preventing those spillovers. What instead you can do is detect them early and respond to them effectively. And to do that, you need infrastructure. You need to have the technology to be able to do diagnostic tests. You need people who are trained to do those tests, to do regular surveillance. You need trained epidemiologists who can spot new signs of outbreaks and who know how to deal with them, who can find the contacts of people who are infected, who can, who know good, solid, old school, on the ground public health. And all of that, that infrastructure requires attention and it requires resources. And that's very difficult when you're in a developing country where resources are scarce. So there is a very strong argument, I think, that richer nations need to help poorer nations build up their own health security, their own ability to respond to and control their own outbreaks. And I think there are two lines of logic for this. One is a moral argument. It's, you know, that's what I believe in, that that this is and there is an ethical responsibility here. But even if, like, you don't buy that, even if you're not, like, pro the concept of foreign aid, there is an entirely selfish reason as well to make these kinds of investments, which is, if diseases run out of control at their points of origin, in this connected world, they are much more likely to then escape borders and enter into new countries and spread all around the world. There have been so many examples where this has been the case. So even from a purely selfish perspective, this ethic of global cooperation and investment in global health is just the smart strategy.
Yeah, it just, first of all, you kind of wish that Donald Trump and maybe some of his relevant cabinet and other officials could sit down, even since they're not really good at briefings or reading long papers and stuff. Like, watch the movie Contagion. You really kind of get a sense of how easily something can leave one place and get into another place. And keeping out people who don't look like Gwyneth Paltrow isn't going to work. But let's just sort of back up and say, I mean, the things that you're saying, maybe we just need to put a finer point on. So you have disease like Ebola, which is spread with bodily fluids. You want good sanitation, right? You want a good waste treatment system, stuff like that. You want a good waste treatment system in the Congo, I mean, let alone in Detroit. It's stuff that when we talk about public health infrastructure, we're talking about, you know, water, sanitation. We're talking about, I assume, vector control of other kinds. And we're also talking about immunization in those countries.
Right. I mean, so there is now an Ebola vaccine. It's, you know, there's still questions about to what extent it is useful. It was used in the last Ebola outbreak, the most recent one that came to an end just yesterday in the Congo. But you know that's part of it. But I think you're getting at that you're getting at correctly that a lot of this infrastructure comes down to more basic measures. You know, it's not the like latest fanciest tools of science and technology. Often it's very basic stuff that just is lacking. When I went to the Congo to look at places that had seen massive Ebola outbreaks in the past, there is still a lack of basic protective equipment, by which I mean things like gloves and hospital gowns. You know, Ebola is not a very contagious disease. It doesn't spread readily through the air like flu does. It only spreads through contact with bodily fluids. So, you know, having people in a place that has experienced Ebola, like handling blood samples with glove, with bare hands and no gloves, is a problem. And like, these people are very well trained. They're very well experienced. They know what to do. They just don't have the materials. And partly that's again to do with this problem of forgetfulness, that we go through these peaks and troughs of readiness and then unpreparedness, because these are risks that last beyond the time spans of institutional memory or electoral cycles. And that's, you know, they kind of prey upon this human foible of being unable to really deal with long-term risks that are a little bit nebulous and hard to think about.
It also seemed, though, Ed, I mean, on the one hand, you go to the Democratic Republic of Congo and you see, yeah, there are medical technicians there who they do understand what to do and how to do it and what kind of protections to use. They just don't have the resources that they need. Mm-hmm. But you also saw cultural practices, not among medical technicians, but just among people whose relatives get sick. And so, I mean, look, I'm, you know, from a white Protestant background. If somebody gets Ebola, we'll just put them out in the driveway and never go near them again. But, you know, in different cultures, people react different ways. In And one way that you can react in some cultures is when somebody you know and love is sick, you touch them and you hug them, right? Maybe you can say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so community is so, so strongly felt in the Congo. When people are sick, it's the family's responsibility to look after them and to help nurse them back to health. You know, so people will go to hospital wards and hang out like around the buildings while their loved ones are recuperating. If they die, the funeral rites are all about love and community. So people will hug the body. They will clean and dress it. They will spend time with it. There's not this same feeling that we have in the West of like, you are sick, you must stay away from me. And I personally find these rituals like very moving. They're all about love and bonds of community. But things like Ebola find it much easier to spread because of some of these practices. And I think that, again, this is why public health is important, because I think local people are better placed at explaining how to change one's practices in a way that is culturally sensitive and understanding of these local customs. And, you know, I think that we in the West should be wary of looking at these practices with a skeptical eye, because we have our own problems too. You know, there's a huge amount of anti-vaccination sentiment in the West. You know, even for diseases where we have vaccines for, we can control them through vaccination, the ultimate form of preparedness, a lot of people choose not to do that. The people I talked to in Western Hospital bemoaned the lack of good infection control. It is very hard to get people in US hospitals to wash their hands adequately. Same problem that I heard when I went to the Congo and talked to people there. So, you know, a lot of these problems, these psychological and societal problems, actually transcend countries, they transcend administrations, and they are, I think, the core of what we need to grapple with when we think about preparedness.
Yeah, I'm sure people from other cultures, when they go to a Western hospital, it's not as prevalent now, but for a long time in hospitals, there were all these doctors walking around with neckties on, drag across surfaces, picking up things as they go. It's like the worst idea in the world, and it's a completely unnecessary thing. A necktie doesn't do anything. So yeah, we have our own weird cultural practices. We just don't think they're weird because they're ours.
Right.
So let's take a quick break here. So that's a little bit about how you could do some prevention stuff, but how about containment? How about an outbreak? That's where we're going to go next.
A plague upon the houses and a plague upon the trees. A plague on all the birds that fly and a plague upon the bees. You are a plague upon the surface.
Mr. Amoff, I'm sorry. Your wife is dead.
I mean, I just saw her. We were just at home.
Is there somebody that we can call? Someone who you think should be here with you?
Wait, sorry, sir. We had dinner. We had pizza. She said she was jet lagged.
Some people get a disease and live. Some get sicker and die. Now, we're going to have to notify the medical examiner, and they may request an autopsy. Or if you wish, we can order one. But I can't guarantee it's going to tell you any more than I can. I mean, my best guess is that this was either meningitis or encephalitis, and with encephalitis, we're in the dark a lot of the time. If it was summer, I might say a bug bite, you know, West Nile. Herpes can cause encephalitis.
She didn't have herpes. What are you talking about? What happened to her?
That is from Contagion. So President Trump, watch the rest of the movie and gather all your advisors around. We are talking about pandemics right now with Ed Young, writes about science for The Atlantic and is the author of I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and A Grander View of Life. We were just recalling during the break that that show actually changed our lives and our behaviors quite a bit. And Betsy Kaplan and I both cut way down on our Purell use and started being much more inviting of a rich, diverse biome, not only inside us, but outside us. And I started like petting my dogs a lot because they're really dirty and they're full of germs and stuff, and that's really good. Anyway, we got to rerun that show. It's a really good show. Anyway, we're talking about something else. Right now, we're talking about pandemics and plagues. He's got a piece in the current issue of the Atlantic when the next plague hits. Also joining us is Eric Toner, senior scholar with Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and senior scientist for Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Environmental Health and Engineering. So we're going to have Eric and Ed talk a little bit about what happens when there's an outbreak, how do we contain it, how do we deal with it. So Eric Toner, first of all, welcome to our conversation.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Maybe we could just begin with by saying that although we began the show talking about the overall lack of preparedness of the United States and the declining preparedness as this administration jettisons money for it and people who know a lot about it, it is true that the United States government runs or has in the past run simulations. So tell us about, I guess it's called Clade X, or tell us about Dark Winter. What are these things?
So these are exercises, tabletop exercises that we at the Center for Health Security have organized over the last couple decades. And the most recent one was called Clade X, which we happened at really around the same time as Tim Zimmer was let go. And it simulated an evolving catastrophic pandemic caused by a bioengineered pathogen. And our intent was to show the potential for pandemics, whether they're caused by naturally occurring pathogens or biologically engineered ones, and demonstrate the policy issues, the kinds of issues that national leaders would have to deal with. So this exercise, like the previous ones we've done, involved former members of the U.S. government, senior leaders, mostly former cabinet officials, playing their prior roles and dealing with the kinds of challenges they would face during a severe pandemic.
All right. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that and sort of what happens when the disease starts very quickly to get out in front of the people who are trying to contain it. But let's go back to Ed for a second. Ed, in an ideal world, as that happened, as the scenario unfolded, we would have, in an ideal world, a lot of biocontainment units, not unlike the one at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Quickly, Ed, just give us a sense of what that is like.
Okay, so this is a unit that I think is one of the best prepared in the country to deal with things like Ebola and SARS and deadly diseases that are rare and that require special efforts. So the unit is under negative air pressure, which means when you go in, the air rushes in with you and stops viruses from escaping. Everything is very carefully sealed. There are UV light stands around to disinfect, to decontaminate rooms after they've been used. There are facilities for getting rid of waste. There are protective equipment so that people can treat patients. You know, every little detail is considered so that viruses can't move from patients to anywhere else, but that people can still receive the best possible medical care. Now, there are 10 beds in this facility, and it is one of the largest in the countries of its kind. So there are not a lot of hospitals that have the same level of preparedness. And you know, when it comes to something like Ebola or like SARS, it shows that there are limits. There's sort of a ceiling to what we can do. And, you know, bear in mind that this facility was dormant for about 9 years after its creation. It was the work of people who had this idea that the hospital needed to be ready to deal with these threats. And after the unit was created, nothing happened. And nothing continued to happen until the big West African outbreak of Ebola, when people were medevaced back to the US and three patients were treated there. So I think my point here is that preparedness isn't in the context of the US, when preparedness often faces these challenges of short-sightedness and forgetfulness, it often boils down to the will of like individual people, right, working at institutions where they can make a difference and where they can say, we need to have stuff ready during peacetime, even though they're not actually being used now. And we need to get people trained in time. We need facilities made. That's a difficult ask to make and to then justify over time. But I think it's what we need. It's the whole ethos that we should be striving for in all areas of policy.
Well, Eric Toner, when Ed says not a lot of hospitals have that level of preparedness, I mean, that's almost an understatement, right? Hardly any hospitals have that level of preparedness.
Absolutely. Until the Ebola outbreak and the handful of cases in the U.S., there were only four units in the U.S., Nebraska being the largest. And now we have 10. Mm-hmm. And together, the 10 units could maybe handle a few dozen patients. So we're talking about a minuscule capability for handling these really serious infectious diseases.
So Eric, let's go back then to the simulation. Now we should add that these simulations, I mean, one of the realities of this is you often don't know exactly what it is you're dealing with or where it's coming from. In the case of Ebola or maybe a detectable influenza outbreak, yeah, you can get pretty specific about it. But some of these things are going to come in as problem X you don't even know. And I think in Clade X, I believe that was sort of bioterrorism by a Japanese apocalyptic style cult, right? That was some religious group getting an antigen of some kind in here.
It was not a Japanese group.
Oh.
It was actually an international group headquartered in Switzerland.
I was misinformed about Clade X.
No, it was somewhat loosely based on the Aum Shinrikyo group in Japan that attempted bioterrorism and also chemical terrorism, a couple decades ago.
Yeah, sure.
But it was the same idea, and that is that today. Bioterrorism can be executed by people other than state-sponsored programs. The revolution in biology has allowed us to manipulate organisms and the genetic material within organisms much more easily. And so this capability exists actually very widely and no longer requires a national weapons program to achieve it.
Eric, one of the things that I found fascinating in reading about these simulations is that these people, and once again to stress, these people who are acting in the roles of key American officials, they're not from community theater. They're people who basically had these jobs or jobs that are very similar, or maybe the Secretary of Defense is a former U.S. senator with a lot of defense expertise. That's who's there doing this. So
yep.
They're trying to make these decisions and get out ahead of them. And one of the fundamental questions that comes up, if the thing is running way ahead of our capacity to deal with it through pre-containment or vaccination or anything else, is at what point do you start doing things that might be described as un-American, right? You ultimately, it's like the movie Outbreak. They're talking about firebombing a town in Northern California because there's Ebola there. And so what happens in the kind of situation room where these officials are trying to decide at what point is this so serious that I can't worry too much anymore about whether this is the kind of thing our country typically does?
Well, we were very fortunate in Clade X and in our previous exercises to have very smart, well-informed, experienced players who are not likely to go down those paths too far. But yet, even with them, they quickly go to think about things that are not a good idea. So immediately, there's questions about travel bans. There are questions about mass quarantine. There are questions about preserving resources for our people and not giving it to other people, not sharing vaccines, not sharing medicines. These kinds of things, which we know from lots of experience are bad ideas, seem on the surface to a lot of people to be relatively simple solutions. And they're not.
Right. But, Eric, if we knew that they were all bad ideas, we could disqualify them. But they're not all bad ideas. For example, if I were in that room, I would nationalize the hospital system on, like, day two or something. Because you really can't have all these private hospitals making all their own little independent decisions about what they're going to do and who they're going to treat and how they're going to handle this.
Well, that's actually one of the scenarios that we built into it. A suggestion was made in the exercise to nationalize the health system. And the question immediately becomes, well, how do you do that? Who has the legal authority to do that? How do you make healthcare workers work, take care of patients they don't want to take care of? Who's going to operate the hospitals? And the federal government doesn't have hospital administrators or nurses or doctors to send there. So none of these issues have easy solutions.
Although, once again, you know, Ed, we're back to that idea of culture and training. One thing that was discovered back in 1918 is that reasonably well-trained hospital workers who were young and healthy and probably had, you know, as much, although being young in 1918 was maybe not necessarily a great idea, but they would stay by their posts and do their work. And I'm guessing if you train your workforce properly and make sure that they're fully, you know, immunized and have the best possible chance that, you know, most of them are probably gonna respond pretty well. But you can't do that, Ed, on the day this all starts happening. You've got to create that culture over the course of years, I would assume.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, going back to the Nebraska example, they trained how to use that facility for all that time when it was lying dormant. They worked out, they practiced regularly at working as a team, at putting on their protective equipment and moving people from like simulated flights to the hospital. So when they actually got patients, they weren't just going, what? What now? You know, they're relying on experience and muscle memory. But, you know, I want to add that public health people are kind of unsung heroes, right? An awful lot is asked of them. Very little credit is then given to them. And they're asked to do all of this work and protect us from a myriad of public health threats using dwindling resources and often with dwindling staff. So preparing and doing that training and getting the experience built in takes time, and it definitely takes money. And all the budgets for doing that work have been on the decline, not just in this administration, but in past ones. And that, again, speaks to this idea of short-sightedness.
Eric, one of the things that intrigues me. Okay, so at a certain point, let's say once again that you're doing these simulations. We're not catching up with the problem. There does come a point where some measures probably need to become compulsory. Now, it could be something as simple as saying, let's close all the schools and let's have no public gatherings, or just, you know, put in some place some things that kind of slow the spread of something. But Americans don't like compulsory things. It's wired into our Constitution and into our hearts and souls that we don't like compulsory things. I read in one place that based on some of the experiences of 1918, there's like this 1% number that if 1% of the sick people die, which would be 3 million people in America, you can start being compulsory. Is that the kind of thing that that these simulations have looked at?
We didn't look at that specifically. You know, there certainly are a number of public health interventions that are possible and that have a legal standing. So the federal government and state governments can implement quarantines. They can forcibly isolate people who are contagious. They can close public gatherings. They can close schools. People don't always like it, but I think generally if they understand the threat to themselves and the threat to their families, they generally comply. As long as these interventions are being used in a way that makes sense. And so it requires a lot of communication, a lot of risk communication, a lot of explanation.
Let me ask you this. I often phrase these questions as kind of magic wand questions, and maybe this isn't quite a magic wand question, Eric Toner, but let's say that I could give you more power than you currently have to change something that you feel is an acute Achilles heel right now. And let's say that I gave you more money than you currently have, more power and resources than you currently have. What's the first thing that pops into your head when I'm saying those things to you?
We need to be able to produce medicines and vaccines for novel new pathogens in months rather than decades. That's what we need.
With that, we're going to take a little break. Thanks once again to Eric Toner, senior scholar with Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and senior scientist for Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in the environmental health and engineering sector. Thanks for being with us. We're going to take a break. Ed's going to stay. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the lessons, some of them really fascinating, that still exist from way back in 1918.
Vegas, come to town, bring out the dead. Bring out the dead. Bring out the dead.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan, with help from me, Kyone Wolf. Our intern is Zandra Ellen, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Dustin Hoffman. On tomorrow's show, a deep look at country music. And now, back to Colin.
He grabbed me, and he ripped at me. He held me, and he ripped at my clothes.
I think you should just calm down.
Oh, I screamed, Johnny! Johnny, help me! Oh, help me! And he wouldn't let me go. He ripped. And then Johnny came and he ran and he fought this man. And I got so afraid. I ran. And Johnny didn't come. We have to wait for Johnny.
Don't you know what's going on out there? This is no Sunday school picnic.
Don't you understand? My brother is alone.
Your brother is dead.
No!
See, we have this huge popular culture about that's from Night of the Living Dead, by the way. And we have this huge pop culture about pandemics, all these zombie shows like, you know, Walking Dead and stuff like that. It's also about a band of hardy survivors who are still around after the pandemic. The problem is with pandemics, you know, a lot of times you're just not in the band of hardy survivors, depending on how bad they are. A lot of people aren't in the band of hardy survivors. And that certainly was the case in 1918. The Spanish flu, one of the most undocumented or at least poorly remembered moments of history, maybe the most unremembered moment in the history of the 20th century. Still with us to talk about pandemics is Ed Yong, who writes about science for The Atlantic, is the author of I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and A Grander View of Life. His recent article, When the Plague Hits, is in the current issue of The Atlantic. Joining us now is author also of another, it really is kind of a wonderful book. If it's possible to write a beautiful book about such a horrible thing, Laura Spinney did it, a science journalist and author most recently, Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. So, Laura, first of all, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
All right. Laura's on Skype. It may take a second or two for the Skype to cook up so that we get a full sound from her. But so, Laura, I think you share, I know from reading your book, that you share my view that when you think about the impact of the flu of 1918, and actually it lasted more than that, but, you know, 50 to 100 million people died, most of them in a very short span of time, September to December of 1918. It's possible, for example, to give you a sense of scale, that more people in India may have died just in India than all of the people who died in World War I. So I guess one of the questions is, why is this always kind of an afterthought when we talk about the calamities of the 20th century?
Well, it's an excellent question. And I was really fascinated by your conversation with Ed about forgetfulness, because, I mean, I think that it is becoming more on our radar, if you like. And this year, the centenary year, is a little bit of a red herring because a lot of people are talking about it. But the fact is still that if you stop someone in the street and say, what were the worst disasters of the 20th century, almost nobody mentions the Spanish flu. And as you said, it killed, we think now, between 50 and 100 million people. To put that in perspective, the First World War killed around 18 million, and the Second World War probably around 50 or 60 million. So it may have killed more than both those world wars put together. And it may even have been more murderous in terms of the number of people, absolute number of people who died, than the Black Death. So it could have been the biggest catastrophe in terms of a single event in the whole of human history. That is possible.
One of the things that appeared to be the case, and one of the problems was there was no actual diagnosis for influenza at that time. So, I mean, everything we think we know about given deaths is a little bit of surmise attached to it. But, when we think about the flu now, we think about who are the at-risk populations, the older people. Older people are considered an at-risk population, and you worry about kids, too. But the Spanish flu actually kind of targeted people, in their 20s and 30s, pretty ferociously.
Yeah, the age group of 20 to 40 was right in the firing line. The very young and the very old as well, although strangely the elderly were more protected in the Spanish flu than they had been in previous flu seasons. And that tells us something, I think, about the way that our immune systems remember their exposure to flu viruses. But again, to get back to the thing about forgetfulness, for most of the 20th century, we didn't know how many the Spanish flu had killed. So I think, you know, that explains partly why we why it's so overshadowed, for example, by the First World War. Also, of course, there was the proximity in time. But I think that flu, which, as Ed mentioned, is like considered by Bill Gates, the British government, and many other worthy institutions and individuals as one of the, if not the major risk in terms of public health to us today, flu also conspires with that forgetfulness, strangely, because a pandemic tends to emerge or erupt pretty much, with the interval of a human lifespan, because what it likes is a global population that is naive to that particular strain of the virus. So people alive have never been exposed to anything like that before, and they forget. And I think that feeds through to our attitudes. You were talking about investment in public health resources. We invest, I think, probably about 10% of what various institutions have calculated we would need to invest in order to make our public health systems resilient to such a disaster. And we have a big and apparently growing problem of vaccine hesitancy. And you hear a lot of people talk about the safety of vaccines, and they talk about the risks, which tend to be minimal, associated with those vaccines, but they never, or they rarely, look at the other side of the equation, which is that those vaccines are only being administered in order to protect us from what the medical community considers a potentially greater risk, which is that of the disease it's designed to give us immunity against. And so you have to look at those two risks and balance them up. And the fact that we've forgotten about the horror of past pandemics means that we tend to reduce in our perception the risk the risk of a future pandemic.
Ed, let's bring you back into the conversation. You know, when we look at these kinds of things, there's two ways that pandemics can be, well, there's more than two, but can be really scary. One of them is the thing that we don't know. We're not ready for it. We've never seen it before. But then the flu is kind of on the other end of it, right? It's something that we do know about. We watch it pretty carefully. We watch strains of it pretty carefully. We try to get the vaccines ready. We're not always good at it. But it's, in a way, it's ubiquity, and also the ease with which it spreads. It spreads more easily than, as you said, Ebola does, makes it an especially dangerous enemy.
Absolutely. The fact that it changes all the time, it's constantly evolving, which means that even though we do have a vaccine, that vaccine needs to be regularly updated, and we're sort of playing this constant guessing game about which strains are going to pose the biggest problems in future years. We're also playing the same game in terms of pandemic strains, strains that aren't part of the usual seasonal circulating package of flu that hits us every year, that are new, that could cause large-scale devastation of the kind that that Laura ably described. And we are looking out for flu viruses. The surveillance network that looks for flu is arguably better than that for a lot of other potential pandemic threats, but even it has blind spots. You know, back in 2009, it was focused on East Asia when a strain of H5N1 bird flu was deemed to be the most likely to cause a pandemic. And while people's attentions were focused there, a strain of H1N1 arose in North America and promptly caused an unexpected pandemic. Even now, there are blind spots all around the world, despite having learned lessons from 2009. So, you know, flu just kind of keeps you guessing. It is a very, very tricky and constantly changing adversary, and it seems to have a knack for doing the unpredictable and unexpected.
One of the things we won't have enough time for is to give you even a hint of the incredible flavor of Laura Spinney's book, A Pale Rider. I really, really do recommend it, and it's just the way in which it depicts the way the flu affected the tides of history in ways that you wouldn't have guessed, or something like apartheid, also the way that it touched various cultural figures from Apollinaire, who died from it, to Sigmund Freud, who's one of his, I think his daughter died from it. It's just really, really fascinating and atmospherically very rich. But Laura, towards the end, you do look at some of these modern questions. And boy, this is just me, I think. But one thing that really jumped out at me was a study being done, co-authored by Nicholas Christakis, who fairly recently was the master of Silliman College at Yale, not too far from here. And he was looking at this really fascinating thing. Like, how could you get, I keep using this phrase, to get ahead of something. So let's say that it takes some of these World Health Organizations about a week even to figure out what's going on. He asked this really interesting question, right? Which is, maybe there's a whole bunch of people that you should vaccinate first because they just know more people.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating piece of research, as you say. And in fact, the concept behind it is not particularly new. People were talking about this back in the 1920s, in fact, even before the Spanish flu. It's the idea that something like a disease, an infectious disease, but also a fashion or a rumor, spreads through a human population according to it, the way it's structured in terms of its social networks. Okay, so if you could understand something about those social networks, then you could perhaps intervene more effectively at hubs or, you know, places where the disease or fashion is spreading very fast, not that you would necessarily need to intervene with the fashion, but and that you could stop the spread of the disease more effectively. And what's new in the 21st century is that they can do, you know, sophisticated mathematical modelling of these things. And Christakis and his colleagues took data from the 2009 flu pandemic, the so-called swine flu pandemic, and they modelled it. And they found that basically, So the idea is based on something called the friendship paradox, which is that somebody that you think of as your friend is probably better connected socially than you. And it's a kind of mathematical trick. It doesn't really mean anything. You don't need to be worried about your unpopularity. But it's a mathematical fact, which means that, which enabled them to divide a student population into one group of undergraduates and another group who they had nominated as friends. And basically, the flu spread more quickly through the group of friends than through the initial group of undergraduates.
Right.
And it struck them probably about 2 weeks earlier. So the idea is that if you could identify those friends, those better socially connected people in the population before a pandemic struck, and followed them, monitored them, then you'd have at least a two-week advance on when a pandemic was going to become a big problem. And not only that, but you could be more effective in your interventions, because imagine you were to vaccinate all those socially important people, then they're the ones who are more likely to step into the path of other people and infect them when they're unvaccinated. But once vaccinated, you're going to attain quickly, more quickly, something called herd immunity. This is actually something that's quite difficult to get with flu anyway, because of the not brilliant effectiveness of the vaccine and the fact that not everybody gets it. But you're going to get closer to a point where the entire population is protected because key people within it are not spreading that disease. And so you're going to save a lot more lives.
Right. It's really just fascinating stuff. The way that I simplify it is the same people who spread jokes spread flu. So you just vaccinate them. So we're almost out of time here. Laura, just very quickly, Ed is talking about the rush to try to keep up with the strains and figure out where the danger is going to come from and therefore the inadequacy of some of the vaccines. Why is there no universal vaccine? And how far away does that seem to you?
Well, it depends who you ask. Some people will say we'll have one in 5 years. Some people say that it may not be possible. We are always about 5 years off getting one. In theory, it should be possible. And if it did exist, it would be a huge leap forward, because it would essentially mean that you could vaccinate people against all flu strains that are circulating now in the world and all future ones that could potentially cause a future pandemic. So it would be an enormous, enormous advance. Mm-hmm. And that's why many groups are currently working on it, and some are even in early clinical trials. So, we should have some information quite soon about whether, at least whether we're on the right track.
Right. I'm excited about the stem. There's one part of the virus that doesn't change that much. All right. So we have to say goodbye to everybody right now. Thanks to everybody who helped out, including Eric Toner, who's not with us anymore. Ed Young, who writes about science for The Atlantic, did a great show with us based on I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and A Grander View of Life. This has been its own kind of terrific show. And Laura Spinney, a science journalist and the author of most recently of Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. I really do recommend both of those books that I just mentioned. And I'm not just saying that to suck up to the guests. The guests are gone. I have no incentive to lie to you or curry favor with the guests. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan, nurse, in addition to a producer who got all this stuff going.